All right. Hello and welcome to Morning Energy Live. I'm your host, Andrew Gillick, and today I have the distinct pleasure or honor of sitting down with the Green Chicken, who many of you know as Doomberg. And you also may know that he has currently created the most read financial note on Substack. A couple of years back, I was turned on to this newsletter by our Chief Product Officer, Jimmy Fortuna, as a source of data-driven science or physics-based research presented in a concise, thoughtful manner. And every time I read one of his notes, I find myself adding to the list of topics I need to learn more about. Adding to the intrigue, of course, is the identity of the team remains a bit of a mystery, but the content they deliver is not. So, Dumi, welcome to the show.
Andrew, fantastic to be here. I'm really looking forward to it. I always love live Q&As. It's adds a
That's what
different
we're here
dimension
for.
than just a
It's going to be
recorded
fun.
podcast. Yeah.
All right, so this is the part of the show where I ask my guest a few questions so the audience can get to know you a little better. I'm not sure how well you want them to know you, but I don't think any of them are as penetrating, and so that they'll be able to guess your identity. So can we start there?
Sure, you bet. Looking forward to it.
All right, good. First question is, what is the first concert you ever went to?
Yeah, I thought you would like this answer, Andrew. The first concert I can remember going to was Vanilla Ice opening up for Milli Vanilli.
Oh, I don't even
That
know what to say.
might
That's
date me a little
fantastic.
bit.
Ah, so many memories rushing back there. That's pretty
Blame it on the
funny.
rain,
All right,
Andrew.
but of course. All right, next question: beach or mountains? Now, mind you, this is a
Oh.
year-round commitment, not seasonal.
Yeah, mountains for sure.
Now, the soothing
For
sound of the
sure.
ocean, not your jam.
No. Give me a river instead.
All right. Have you been to more states or countries?
Countries, but I've been to a lot of states.
Sounds like the chicken's well traveled.
Yes, used to be.
Used to be. All right. Next, what is the best energy source?
Oh, nuclear by far.
Not
Energy
even a
density for
debate.
the win. Yeah, for the win.
I think you're finding a lot of converts there in that, and hopefully we can do something about it down the road. All right, final question. What is the best sandwich?
I would have to go with the McChicken as previously made in Canada before they switched the formula.
Wow. I wish I
So
knew
I know
what
that's
that was like.
it's a real delight. What can I tell you?
Good stuff. All right. Well, thanks. That was great. Now, look, before we hop into discussion, I know a lot of folks are really excited to hear your thoughts on the space. Why don't you just, to the extent that you can, tell us a little bit about why you started Doomberg.
Yeah, sure. Doomberg is a small team of former executives from the energy commodity sector. We did a lot of consulting before COVID. COVID ruined our business. We reinvented ourselves and started consulting in the content space. For people that created content and sold it into Wall Street, helping them run their businesses better. One of our best clients thought that, hey, why don't you just start your own? You're pretty good at this. I have a big passion for writing. Another member of the Doomberg team is a world-class editor. And a little over 3.5 years ago, we conceived of the brand, and the ride has been amazing. 250,000 subscribers later, we kind of have to pinch ourselves. It's truly the work of our lives. I love doing it. And if it doesn't feel like work and you found what you were meant to do, then by God, just keep doing it. And so that's our plan. We publish 8 times a month, roughly. And this is all we do. So it's been amazing. And Substack is a great platform for those that aren't aware. It's really the YouTube for bloggers, and they're kind of winning the network effect race for the written word on the internet. And they're a great team. We've grown with them. It's really just a fantastic experience all around.
Now, as many listeners know, I do love the written word, and I think you're right, Substack is great. So, keep up the good work. All right. So, according to one of your recent videos, it sounds like statistical review release day is a favorite day over at the Bloomberg Nest. So maybe we can start there. Big picture, what are some of the big takeaways you had from this year's release on your expectations of future consumption?
Yeah, so the BP Statistical Review, as it used to be known, and it's now the Energy Institute's Statistical Review, that is released annually about halfway through the year. And as you say, it's our Christmas Day. The breadth and depth of data that's available, that is, sort of politically agnostic, not massage. You just get the raw data by fuel, by country. And it really is hard to hide from the data. I think the sort of big headlines from the 2024 edition is that, you know, China continues to emit more carbon than all of the OECD countries combined. It has signaled zero intent to stop that growth. In one of the pieces, we mentioned that China added 22 New Zealands over its 2022 emissions. It emits more in a day than New Zealand does in a year. It's really remarkable.
But New Zealand's going to be zero soon, right?
Yes.
They're going to net
to the nearest number that matters, they're already zero.
Yeah, exactly.
But the other thing is fossil fuels are not being displaced. All primary energy sources are additive, and the data clearly shows that. Oil set a record, natural gas tied a record, coal set a record, hydro and nuclear are all in the mix, and renewables are still low single digit, while wind and solar individually are still low single digit sources of primary energy, growing relatively fast, of course. But our view is that none of this will displace fossil fuels. The gating function of demand for fossil fuels is production. And we've developed something called Dumbrick's postulate, which says that every molecule of fossil fuels produced will be burned by somebody somewhere, and local restrictions against such activities merely shift who gets to enjoy that privilege. The developing world is going to develop. If we don't burn coal, they will. If we don't burn oil, they will. And renewables aren't going to bend the arc of that. And the data is just so pronounced and so clear. That's the biggest takeaway from it, that the sacrifices being made in the Western world are effectively being made in vain.
Meaning the sacrifices to reduce emissions and all the money that's being spent is
if you just take Europe, like take what Europe is doing. This is virtue signaling, I guess, would be the kindest way to describe it. They are sacrificing the standards of living of their citizens in the name of saving the planet by reducing global emissions, but global emissions keep going up because every molecule produced will be burned. And so since Europe doesn't produce much in the way of fossil fuels, it really can't affect what the world does. If Indonesia is going to produce, you know, low-grade thermal coal, somebody's going to buy it, and somebody's going to burn it, and there's going to be a lot of carbon emissions associated with the heat that's generated that's used to, you know, spin a turbine somewhere. And so, you know, when you look at the global south and their energy use per capita, we have a long way to go. We had a Protear webinar called Year of the Dragon, China Through the Lens of Energy, which we leaned on the statistical review for much of the analysis. If China's BTU per capita were to suddenly match the US's overnight, all things being equal, the world would need 36% more exajoules of energy than we currently consume just with the flick of a switch. And by the way, they're going to want to reach and surpass our standard of living. That is the human endeavor. The human endeavor is a constant, unrelenting struggle against the forces of entropy, and you have to waste heat in order to impose order. And so, but we're still going to have to be mindful of trends and government policies around renewables and nuclear and everything else. But if you ask me what the big headline is from that great spreadsheet that they so graciously published for free, it would be that.
Got it. Well, no, that certainly makes sense. And those are the trends that we've been following as well. And so why don't we sort of break it down into some of the other categories, starting with oil. When you think about oil price today, obviously last week's been disappointing for many producers. Oil's prices are historic lows in real terms. Does that seem right to you? Should there be a risk premium based on what's going on in the world? If so, how much? If not, you know, where are your thoughts right now on crude oil pricing?
I think crude oil is kept artificially high by OPEC, which is what all cartels do. I think what's driving the headwinds in oil is the complete glut of natural gas seen around the world. And much of that glut is formed by, you know, the associated byproducts of the Permian and, you know, and various other producing fields where you get natural gas as a consequence of oil. If oil is going to be held artificially higher, they're going to keep drilling, which means you have to do something with the natural gas. But natural gas is a great fuel if you have the capacity to burn it. And with a arbitrage gap, say in the US, $2 per million BTU natural gas is what, $13 or $15 a barrel oil, people are going to switch the engines. And this is a call we made at the end of last year when we wrote a relatively controversial piece called Peak Cheap Oil is a Myth. Our basic headline is they would switch the engines, and we're seeing that especially in China, which is, of course, net short energy and short oil in particular, and is the world's largest oil importer. And we believe at least some of the headwinds can be ascribed to the fact that China in particular are switching from diesel to LNG in their trucking sector at a very rapid speed, you know, China speed, and it's affecting the markets. And we have other sort of economic potential uncertainties that are certainly a drag, but when you have a glut of energy, arbitrages tend to close downward. We have a glut of natural gas, and to the extent that people will forego creating heat from oil and create heat from natural gas instead, which happens to be a cleaner burning fuel, which is part of the driver for what we're seeing in China, they will, and it doesn't take much. So the thing about primary energy is they're fungible, but they're also inelastic in the sense that it doesn't take much in the way of demand switching for that to be seen in the physical markets. And so the global markets for energy are well supplied. We often say the most important question a macroeconomic analyst should ask themselves is the world net long or short primary energy? The question itself implies two possible answers. We came of age during an energy crisis where the world was short primary energy, but that flipped. Most shortages lead to gluts, and we're in a bit of a glut right now. And this associated byproduct economics, especially in the US, is driving much of that. That which can't go on forever usually doesn't. You're not going to be paying people to take natural gas from you in the Permian. Pipelines will be built. Demand applications will be developed. And I think AI is probably going to cure some of this glut. I think we're going to see a wave of natural gas-fired power plants being built to power data centers and to train LLMs. And that's going to be a huge trend that the U.S. is going to lead. And I think this glut of natural gas is well-timed to keep the U.S. at the forefront of the AI and computing revolutions.
You just like created 17 different questions for me right there. The idea that crude is weak or weakening now is not surprising to you because it's been held artificially high. And you're saying that the shift is on to using more natural gas and transportation and whatnot. We're not really seeing that here in the United States, but if you're seeing it in China, you're probably seeing it in India and other places. Like, how quickly do you think natural gas can displace oil in terms of transportation, or where the other areas you're seeing it being used?
Yeah, and I see one of the attendees has asked that question, so we'll knock it off here. Can we quantify the substitution effect? So just to give you some quantification, in April, Bloomberg reported that 1/3 of the new trucks sold in China were powered by natural gas, predominantly LNG, which is a truly amazing number. I've seen various estimates for the displacement of diesel demand, anywhere between 200,000 to 800,000 barrels a day, which would be material. I think the global demand for diesel is around 30 million barrels a day. And it doesn't take much, a couple of percentage points. Look, when Biden drained the strategic oil reserve at 1 million barrels a day, that was 1% of daily supply, and the price of oil was cut in half. And so I could easily explain the last $10, right, in that case. Saudi Arabia famously burned several 100,000 barrels of oil a day to produce electricity. They vowed to switch that to natural gas. Iran is the largest producer of natural gas in OPEC, and it has the world's largest fleet of CNG-powered passenger vehicles. India, we were joking before we came on air that a hybrid means something different over there. There are hybrid engines being built for switching between diesel and natural gas. The shipping industry, you know, with all of the pollution controls that are going into place, natural gas is a very clean-burning fuel. And we're seeing LNG-powered cargo ships being built. BYD, just the electric vehicle manufacturer, has one. And then if you look across China, you have electric vehicles displacing gasoline demand, and you have trucks displacing diesel demand. Well, there's like 2/3 of the crack. And that demand is gone, right? So for those that have traveled to and from China at various points, one of the most important things that the CCP is focused on is the PM 2.5 measurements in Beijing and Shanghai, particulate matter 2.5. They actually care about what the population thinks of their performance. And there's nothing more damning than to walk out in Beijing or Shanghai and into a black cloud of smog and dust, right? Well, the two key drivers of that are coal, which they're burning in record amounts, and diesel in trucks in the city. And they're going to displace that diesel with natural gas. But also on the coal side, we're seeing this amazing build out of coal plants. That's just mostly just displacing old ones that don't have pollution controls with new state-of-the-art ones that do. And so there's a
mix. So all the new coal plants are not additional, they're more replacing?
There's mostly replacing with some additional. That's our view. If you just look at the growth rate versus the construction rate, it has to be that they're closing down unsophisticated, old, highly polluting power plants and replacing them with, proper scrubbers and modern. You know, if you look at a coal plant in Germany and you look at an old coal plant in China, they're two vastly different factories, so to speak.
Right.
And I do think at least some of the wave of coal plants being approved in China is to displace old ones with superior pollution controls. And so that's the trend that we see. And by the way, as long as this arbitrage is open, like natural gas is so cheap in the U.S. and we have so much, unlike other petro states, the U.S. has a very sophisticated downstream manufacturing sector with hundreds of cogeneration plants that are burning natural gas to produce steam and electricity. And they're all at a huge advantage to their global competitors. This is, we wrote a piece in earlier this year called Slick Landing, where we predicted that the U.S. would not fall into a recession in large part because of the glut of natural gas. If really expensive energy causes recessions, and certainly dirt cheap clean energy helps abate them.
So in the beginning of our conversation, you were talking about, you know, the continued consumptions of fossil fuels. They're not going to be displaced, but they're displacing each other, I guess. So is the, when we think about the ARB, and we know that ARBs always close, how long is it going to take this ARB to close, and are prices going to catch up or down?
Depends on where you're, which side of the jaw you're on, right?
Yeah.
I think that historically, natural gas just can't sit here at what?
Two and a quarter, wherever it is.
The oil to gas ratio is what, 35?
Right. Yeah.
And thermodynamically, it should be 6, and historically, it's traded between 9 and 15 because of the logistics premium. It has traded as high as 50 this year, and in the Permian, of course, it's infinite because they're paying people to take natural gas.
Right.
We just saw that the Matterhorn pipeline is beginning to make some baby steps towards coming online, and that 2.5 BCF per day of offtake capacity is going to enable more oil production. Guyana, Chevron's offshore breakthrough. We're writing about Argentina soon, and Vaca Muerta is going to be a huge player. Somewhere between Eagle Ford and Permian, more oil than Eagle Ford, but more gas than the Permian, if you could believe that. It's huge. And it's coming online, big supply. And so I think, as you said, the price of oil, that this part about this whole peak cheap oil stuff, which I think is frankly nonsense. If you just plot the price of oil in ounces of gold and then go back 50 years, you'll see that oil's never been cheaper in real terms,
right.
With the exception of COVID. The oil and gas industry are amazing technological companies that execute acts of magic, really, to keep society going. But they're also giant deflationary machines. If supply is needed, they know where to go get it. And our view is that we should, the world will have as much fossil fuels as it chooses to burn.
Okay, so as we were thinking about all the LNG, the liquefaction capacity coming online here in the United States on the Gulf Coast, plus on the West Coast in Canada, plus in the Middle East, do you believe that that's going to lift prices here in the U.S., or is there just too much gas out there for it to matter?
Based on the statistical review, we offer a really interesting question is how much intra-market penetration do you need for prices to normalize? And right now, LNG is 14% of the U.S. natural gas trade. I'm sorry, of the global natural gas trade.
Okay.
And that's pretty close. So our view of the long-term equilibrium price is that landed LNG and Brent crude should roughly trade the same on an energy content basis, and they are today. So if you look at the TTF contract, Dutch TTF times 5.8, you get roughly the price of Brent. And that means natural gas being fed into those LNG export terminals would have to sell for some lower price than that for everybody in the value chain to earn their cost of capital. But right. It can sell much higher than two and a quarter per million BTU. So if landed LNG is 12, 13, you know, that means the equilibrium natural gas price is probably between 5 and 8, you know?
In North America, you mean?
In North America or any export, you know, you forgot about Mexico, right? Which is basically going to connect to the Permian and then build an LNG export terminal or two where they can circumvent the need to pass through the Panama Canal. Same thing we're seeing in British Columbia. Both of those countries basically filling the void that California is voluntarily leaving open. You know, California has amazing resources, including a very large shale deposit that they're leaving undeveloped.
They're saving it for later when they need it, you know.
When the politics finally turn. I think the equilibrium price, when OPEC is defeated, will be, my guess is like the equilibrium price for oil is around $50 a barrel in today's money, which would put LNG at around, you know, $8 to $10 and domestic natural gas between 4 and 6.
I'm not sure $50 really cuts it for the industry in terms of total break-even cost. So we'll have to...
Well, the industry does not have a glorious track record of what we call discipline.
Few years have been great. Lots of capital discipline. Doing a bang-up job. Come on.
And here we are.
Here we are.
$65 WTI.
When one of the LNG headwinds that I think about is if some of that Russian gas that had been piped into Western Europe gets redirected to China through the Power of Siberia pipeline too. Do you think that's something that's going to happen? And as a corollary, like, do you think Russian gas will ever get piped back into Western Europe, even though I know it's still
piped into Western Europe. Yeah.
Just not at the volumes that we had seen before.
I view whether the Power Siberia 2 gets constructed. And for those that are unfamiliar, there's a Power Siberia 1 pipeline, which takes natural gas from the southern fields of Russia into the Chinese network that is flowing several BCF per day. And there's a pipeline that starts in Turkmenistan, which is the other major source of landed, you know, pipeline natural gas into China. There's this third construction, which we had always thought that maybe Xi Jinping was a bit hesitant to execute on because China does not like to become too dependent on any one country for its energy needs. We view whether or not the construction of the Power Siberia 2 project gets the final go-ahead as a key test for the cohesion of BRICS and whether that collective of countries will actually be a sort of formidable peer to the U.S. dollar Western system. I find it very interesting that Putin just visited Mongolia, which is the one country that pipeline would have to pass through. Power Siberia 2 would take gas from the northern fields, as the name implies, from Russia, which had been earmarked to go to Europe, predominantly through, you know, the pipelines that go through Belarus and Ukraine, and obviously the Nord Stream pipelines and the rest of that artery. Some of that is being redirected to LNG exports, although the U.S. is doing its level best to try and impede that. But the Power Siberia 2 project would be a generational rewiring of global energy flows that would connect Russia and China in a very intimate way for a very long period of time, subjecting China to the political risk in Moscow, of course. But Putin flew to Mongolia, which incidentally is an ICC signatory, and technically Mongolia was under the obligation to arrest him. To nobody's surprise, they did not. they gave him quite the welcome, rolled out the red carpet for him. And I think we're getting close to an announcement. And I would put this on your radar for a milestone. Putin is actually hosting a very important BRICS summit next month. You never read about it in the Western media. Xi Jinping is expected to be there. Modi from India is expected to be there. Lula from Brazil.
This is in Moscow?
Kazan. It's in Kazan. This is where the grand rollout of the alternative to the U.S. dollar banking system is rumored to be being percolated. I wouldn't be surprised if, as a consequence of that meeting, we see some announcements around the Power Siberia 2 there. Not predicting that we'll see it, but if we are to see it soon, that would be the meeting where it would be part of the readout in our view.
So I guess China's calculus is who's the more dangerous partner to rely on, Russia, U.S.?
Well, I think China's calculus is Putin leads Russia today, but who knows what NATO will do, right?
Right.
One of the stated objectives of the Ukraine war is to provoke regime change in Russia, whether or not they're successful. And look, the U.S., NATO, G7 countries, the British, these are formidable geopolitical adversaries. We have a century and a half's worth of evidence in that regard. And so becoming too dependent on somebody who is the overt political enemy of the U.S. and the British has never really been a sound strategy. And Xi Jinping is a patient,
right,
sort of patient person who thinks in decades, not years.
Yeah. I don't know. That feels like the one to keep an eye on for global LNG balances, because if that gets done, I think that disrupts where people think gas is going to go.
Yeah, it makes it cheaper for Japan and Korea and Europe, by the way. It makes LNG cheaper for demand for Japan and Korea and Europe. But LNG will never be cheaper than the deal they had that they have foregone as a consequence of the war.
Oh, right. I see what you're saying. All right. So we're coming up on time here. So there are two things that I want to touch on. And we might only get to one of them. So one of the questions that I get all the time is, you know, how is this next president, how will it impact the energy sector? Not because of what their policies are, or because of what their policies are. I used to think blue was bad, red was good for oil and gas, and vice versa for renewables. I don't actually think that's the case anymore. But how are you seeing in this race in particular the impact, you know, depending on who comes into the White House in January?
So I have a bit of a counterintuitive view, which is aligning to what you were hinting at. I think the oil and gas industry does not have a good track record of discipline, and outside discipline imposed on them in the form of regulatory hurdles tends to be good for equity, bad for commodity production numbers, but good for the equities, right? And everybody knows that you make all your money on price, not volume in this business. Every once in a while you get a super spike, and that's when you make, you know, 5 years worth of cost of capital, and then you sort of tread water for all the months in between. I think a Trump win is bullish for production values, which is deeply bearish for commodity equities, and I think a Harris win is bearish for production volumes and bullish for commodity equities as a consequence. And I think when commodity producers face friction from their regulatory regimes, they tend to make more money. And even though I would probably guess that the median executive in the oil and gas sector is probably leans conservative, votes Trump, their pocketbooks would say that Biden has been quite good for them. And that is, I think, and by the way, we're still producing at record levels. But fully left to their own devices in total, they will drill themselves into oblivion, which we've seen over and over again.
Do you think that the international policies of either candidate would have a bigger impact one way or the other?
I think Trump is clearly the overtly anti-war candidate, and peace is bullish for production, bearish for price. And so I think Harris is a continuation of the existing NATO policy orientation towards Russia, which is bullish price, bearish production, and the Middle East as well, full-throated support of Israel and potentially even a war with Iran. That would be very bearish production, extremely bullish price. And so I think across both regards, both regulatory stance and geopolitical desires, the oil and gas sector should be hoping for a Harris-Waltz administration if the only thing they're optimizing is the bid-ask spread and where they are on for their stocks. But, you know,
right.
It'd become harder to produce. So that's a view. And as you know, these commodities are so inelastic, it doesn't take much, right, to swing things. And so, but the discipline, let's just, political discipline is easier to exert than financial discipline.
The one sort of other wild card in my mind is a Trump presidency and a China policy. Is there a scenario where there are certain tariffs that really challenge the global economy that could then be bearish price, I guess?
I think that's an awful lot of campaign bark
Yeah.
as opposed to practical implementation bite. So I think Trump's a deal maker, he's
Yeah.
just opening high and will eventually cut a deal.
Get to
So yeah.
something that makes sense. I get it. Okay. All right. The last question here. What's the number one topic that energy sector participants should be paying attention to now and over the next 12 months,
So I don't know if it,
that we haven't talked about
yeah,
yet?
I don't know if it's a number one topic, but it's the most interesting one for us, which is this background development of the potential for drilling for hydrogen, so-called natural hydrogen or geologic hydrogen. We wrote a provocative piece recently called In Search of the Next Shale. And it turns out that when water meets iron deposits underground, of course, hydrogen is formed. And in some circumstances, it can be collected and trapped and can be drilled for on purpose in theory. And it's the type of breakthrough that could change things, given the scales involved. And in fact, there's a whole other development sort of branch of this tree where if you just pump water underground and it reacts with the hydrogen, you could stimulate the production. It re reacts with the iron and you could stimulate the production of hydrogen. ARPA-E is funding a lot of projects in this regard. Joe Manchin, who is, I think, probably the most lucid legislator the US has had in the past 40 years as it pertains to energy, held an entire hearing on it, which we listened to with great interest, which is linked in the piece. That's an out of left field one that could change the game in the same way that, there were big doubters about whether, the Marcellus Shale would ever produce economic natural gas. Well, look at how foolish those predictions look in hindsight. I think this could be one of those. It is indeed possible, but that's something on our radar. And I only say that, like, as relative importance, if it were to happen, it would be extremely important because hydrogen would flip from being an energy carrier to a true energy source, and it's carbon free. It burns very hot. We know what to do with it. It only produces water when you burn it. We could run our automobiles on hydrogen internal combustion engines quite easily. Toyota has that technology all worked out. You could retrofit existing ICEs relatively cheaply as well if the arbitrage was worth it. So I think that's something that's off the wall. That 5 years from now, you might be glad that you looked into today or not. But that's, I think,
I mean, I'm pretty sure up here on my shelf I have the book, The Hydrogen Economy, from 20 years ago, and
Well, I could
feels like it's
see,
still 10 years away.
I could see, well, that the hydrogen economy where you split water is dumb. Like, that's never going to happen. But the hydrogen economy where you drill for it, that's a different story. I could see
That's
Twilight in the Desert behind you. That's, of
oh
course,
yeah,
everybody grew up reading that book.
it's a good one. I think
And
you're missing the prize, but it's on the other
before
side.
we sign off, I just have to address one question in the Q&A, which is who blew up the
Okay.
Nord Stream
Do it.
pipeline?
Do it.
The cast of Friends did it.
Who was the captain of the boat in that?
It was a 4-hour tour, you see. And they
It was a longer, yeah. So you don't think it was the folks out on the leisurely sailboat cruise?
who knows? If that's what our betters are telling us what happened, then who am I to judge them?
Well, I guess we may never know the truth, Doomberg. We may never know the
Yeah,
truth.
it was the cast of Friends. I'm going with
Yeah,
that.
I'll make note of that in the when we finally find out. He'll tell you're right. All right, well, look, everyone, thank you so much, Doomberg, for joining in. This was great. I really appreciate the time. We could go on for much longer, but we can. And so yeah, again, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Really appreciate it, Andrew. And anytime you want to have us back on, looking forward to it.
Of course, that's a very generous offer. Thank you. All right, everyone else, listen, next time in 2 weeks on Morning Energy Live, I'm going to have Meg O'Neill, CEO of Woodside. We're going to talk about the two deals Woodside just did, one in the traditional energy space and one in the new energy space. So details for that will be out shortly. Otherwise, take care, everyone. Have a great day.